Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the musical chairs in the Kremlin, where the power behind the throne, Vladimir Putin, is stepping out of the shadow of his puppet Medvedev, the current president, to reassume the role as the next president of Russia, a role he never really relinquished. Nina Khrushcheva, a relative of a former Soviet leader and a professor of international relations at the New School, joins us for a reading of the latest Kremlin tea leaves. Then Bob Stern, the president of the Center for Governmental Studies, joins us to look into how a crooked local accountant looted the campaign funds of a lot of the prominent Democratic politicians in California, including Senator Feinstein and Congresswoman Loretta Sanchez, leaving many Democratic office holders vulnerable for re-election in 2012. Then finally, we will speak with Adam Winkler, professor of constitutional law at UCLA, and author of the new book, Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. We will discuss an untold history Adam Winkler's book reveals that explodes the myth of the Wild West and finds that the Ku Klux Klan began as a gun control organization and that the modern gun rights movement was inspired by fear of the Black Panthers. Joining us now is Nina Khrushcheva, who is Professor of International Affairs at the Graduate Program at the New School and a Senior Fellow at the World Policy Institute. She is also an editor and contributor to Project Syndicate Association of Newspapers Around the World. She was a research fellow at the School of Historical Studies at the Institute for Advanced Studies at Princeton, then served as deputy editor of Eastern European Constitutional Review at the NYU School of Law and is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. Dr. Khrushcheva is the author of Imagining Nabokov, Russia Between Art and Politics, and is currently finishing a book, The Lost Khrushchev, A Family Journey into the Gulag of the Russian Mind. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nina Khrushcheva.
Thank you.
And clearly this little sort of shadow game, I refer to it as musical chairs in the Kremlin, how much do you think the West is gullible into believing there actually was some, that Putin wasn't really in charge all along, and that somehow that Medvedev was something more than some window dressing to make the West feel as if there was, you know, somebody out there that was championing modernization and legal reform and was friendly to the West?
I think that the West was pretty aware of what was going on. But what I find very interesting is that although everybody knew who really is in charge and who is the puppet who doesn't pull any strings, which is the President Medvedev, I think it's what really surprises me is the desire for being delusional. And every time when Medvedev would speak on modernization or would promise to confront legal nihilism or fight corruption or go tweet with Steve Jobs or have hamburgers with Barack Obama, somehow that immediately became a sign, oh, he must be a real thing, and that's really good for Russia. That's what absolute clarity for everybody, but the desire to be duped was, that I find very, very interesting in this whole latest development when everybody knew that Putin was coming back. I think there was a hope that he won't, but clearly if you know a bit of Russian politics, or Russian history, you would not be thinking differently. He was to come back. And in fact, I was actually remembering an anecdote today from 2008, very quickly after Medvedev became president, is that it's 2025 and Putin and Medvedev are sitting in a restaurant and Putin says, oh, I forgot, who is paying now? And Medvedev said, oh, I was just reelected back into president, so it's my turn. So, I mean, the public culture, political culture, already knew in 2008 that would happen. And the fact that we are considering it news today is a bit surprising to me.
And you wrote, Nina Khrushcheva, in a piece that you had back in June, Will the Meek Inherit Russia? You mentioned here that U.S. Vice President Joe Biden was in Moscow in March, where he tried to convince Putin to surrender his presidential ambitions for 2012. Apparently, the rumor is that he offered Putin important international positions, such as chairing the International Olympic Committee or even leading the United Nations. What happened to that? Obviously, it didn't work.
It was a rumor. I mean, I don't know what had happened. That was a very persistent rumor. Joe Biden actually did go to Moscow and did meet with Putin and actually talked to Putin on the phone, which for prime minister really should, it's not really prime ministerial job to talk to Joe Biden. So, and also we know that Joe Biden is a very big proponent of Russian democratic development. So there must be something to it, although we don't know exactly whether it happened or not. Well, it clearly happened nothing, but as I wrote in that piece, if Putin really doesn't step aside, which, you know, I sort of assumed that he wouldn't, Lavrentiy Beria's fate awaits him, and I still think it does. Lavrentiy Beria, he was Stalin's secret police chief that when Stalin died and Khrushchev took over, Beria died the death that he sent many, many people to when he was in charge of the secret police. That is, he was accused of being a German spy and died a horrible death. And I think Putin sort of strengthened the hand of various illegal formulas. That is, you can switch presidents, you can put people in prison, and I'm referring to Khodorkovsky, exactly, the UKOS had the oil. So he created a system that in order to get rid of him, would actually have to do something really horrible to him. But clearly, like all Russian czars before him, he's incapable of stepping aside, and he's going to be there until the bitter end. And it really doesn't, doesn't give any good promise, because eventually, if it is another 12 years, I'm sorry, because when Medvedev became president, he, first order of business, he amended the constitution to the new term, which is now 6 years, and you can run for two terms. I mean, you can be elected for two terms, which is another 12 years. Everybody knew that Medvedev wasn't doing it for himself. Who wants Medvedev for 12 more years in Russia? He was doing it for Putin, so he did. So we will have Putin for another 12 years, and I mean, I predict, and it's a horrible prediction, but I do know my Russia, I predict some sort of rebellion. I mean, you know, 1917, 1991 are really not something that you should disregard as historical precedents.
And Nina Khrushchevi, in this article that I'm quoting from that you wrote, you're saying that the current regime is clearly autocratic, yet it aspires to democratic legitimacy in the eyes of the Russian citizens and in the international community, and that clearly is, to some extent, the role that Medvedev was playing here in this shadow game. But you also say that, as in Soviet times, the main task of today's ruling elite, Putin and his former KGB associates, is to preserve their tight-knit political and economic regime built for their personal control and material benefit. Russian foreign policy is, as it was under the Soviets, an extension of official domestic priorities.
Which, you know, I still stand by those words, and in fact, sort of to go back to your original opening of this segment, is that, you know, the musical chairs, Medvedev is now going to be prime minister. I mean, his rhetoric is very soothing. He does talk about modernization. He does talk about technology. He is, he certainly communicates better with democratic leaders. He is not an autocrat Putin is a type of an autocrat. Medvedev is not an autocrat. So Putin does need him as prime minister to soften the image. But at the same time, especially with economy doing badly in all countries, including Russia, he does need, or so he says, or so he presents, he does need the firmer reins in his hands, because clearly his hands are much firmer than Medvedev. So basically what they are now promoting is that it's going to be better for everyone, because Putin has stronger reins, but Medvedev could be much better as prime minister, because he can do his economic things that he's strong at. I mean, he would have better opportunity to meet the promises that he did. That is, he can deal with law, he can deal with corruption, he can deal with economics, which is the job of prime minister.
Again, I'm speaking with Nina Kusheva, Professor of International Affairs in the graduate program at the New School and a senior fellow of the World Policy Institute. So the picture I get from other people and indeed from you, Nina, is that what's going on in Russia today is that Putin sort of regulates a cadre of KGB people that he promoted along with himself, and that they in turn regulate the oligarchs. And that if you get out of line, like Khodorkovsky did, you'll go to jail. So that seems to be the system. Now, is he? Why does he need to be in charge of the system? Why doesn't he just go to Switzerland or go? You know, live off all the billions that these other guys have looted from the state?
Look, I ask myself that every day. Why does he go to Switzerland and just do what Switzerland does? Good question. I mean, you know, it's Russia. That's what we do. We have enormous territory. We've been an empire, and I still say we have been, and as in kind of a lengthy present tense, because the mentality is still there. And once you take power in an empire, you just never let it go. I mean, you know, we had only three precedents in history, really. One was Khrushchev, but he was ousted, although he claimed that he would leave. He wanted to leave in 65. Well, we don't know because he was ousted in 64. Then Gorbachev, whose power was also taken away from him. And the only person who really gave up power on his own was Boris Yeltsin, who in 2000 actually gave it to Putin, the rumor goes that he couldn't really be in the Kremlin anymore for various reasons, including health. So it's a very good question, but that's not how it's done. I mean, you know, the thing about Putin is that he does things in a very predictable way, the way it has been done historically and certainly throughout Soviet history.
But what explains, you touched on Yeltsin, it's often forgotten that it was Yeltsin appointed as Yeltsin's national security advisor and then became his handpicked successor. And I've always been puzzled why a very junior KGB fellow who largely worked in Germany, which was not a prize KGB posting, it wasn't in the West, he never had a very distinguished career. How did this guy get that job, and then how did he become, you know, the boss of the bosses, you know, the capo di capo? How did he become the leader of this clique of KGB people who run KGB Incorporated, otherwise known as Russia?
Well, it's sort of an amazing thing that you're coming back to that. I feel like, you know, in 12 years since Putin been around, I've written anything that there is to say about him. Mm. I think Yeltsin picked him because he seemed like he was a quiet executioner. I mean, I don't mean cutting heads, although he does do that now. But at the time, he was just the guy who you would send him for beer and he would bring it. That's how he appeared. And so Yeltsin picked him for that. I mean, you know, with all my respect to Yeltsin for many things, it was a very corrupt government, very corrupt family, and so their millions had to be protected by somebody, and they made a deal with Putin, who was so it was a very convenient, so that this KGB guy, former KGB guy, comes in, he seems quiet, he just seemed to be, he would just keep Yeltsin's, with no initiative, he would keep Yeltsin's formulas intact, and protect the family fortunes. But of course, in 2000, and I remember, it's remarkable how we all want to be delusional about Russian politics, although there is no delusions left, or illusions left for that matter. You know, Stalin, not that I compare them directly, Stalin came into power the same way. Why, Nikolai Bukharin and Trotsky, they were all fighting over the ministerial position. Stalin was very good executioner. He was walking around the Kremlin corridors, and the only thing he was doing, he was just bringing papers from one office to another. And by the time Trotsky and Bukharin and all those other bright stars of the Bolsheviks finished dividing their ministerial positions, oops, it was too late. Stalin was already there. And, you know, both very quiet, both good executions, both very, seemed very uneventful and quite dull, and yet look what happened. I mean, Stalin has been in power for 30 years, and Putin, I bet, will, if he's not ousted, he will stay there for that long.
And you're suggesting, Nina Khrushcheva, that the difference here, when you, we talk about Stalin and Putin, the fundamental difference is that this clique that are running Russia now, they don't want to completely divorce themselves from the West because that's where their money is and where they have holiday villas and where.
Well, of course, but I mean, it's not as I said, it's not a direct comparison.
No, but on the other hand, they want to prevent Russia's integration with the West because that would mean the end of their regime. That's
absolutely. They want the state to keep as it is. But, I mean, it has been, since Stalin, it has been 50 years, more than 60 years, will be 50, 60 years. It's absolutely not the same. I mean, the book that I'm writing now is The Gulag of the Russian Mind. I mean, we don't really need barbed wire to keep us away from the world. We just do it ourselves. And, you know, and then Putin is a good example. We do it ourselves. So it's different. There is no idea. I mean, Putin doesn't really have ideology. I'm like Stalin, who was a devoted communist and especially believer in communism in one separately taken country. Putin doesn't believe that. I mean, they use strength as a tool. They don't use it as an ideological ideological necessity.
Well, just in closing, Nina, then the question I have when you talk about delusions about Russia and how we don't want to look at the truth in a harsh light, in many ways, when it comes to Putin, it's pretty hard to look at the truth in hard ways because there are some really disturbing questions about his role in what precipitated the second Chechen War, those apartment buildings that blew up that are still very mysterious, his attitudes and statements about Anna Politkovskaya, who was murdered on his birthday, he apparently gave the order to take the theater, and where all those Russians died as collateral damage because the compound they used, the gas, was a state secret. They didn't bother to revive these people, which they could have easily done. And there's a whole bunch of things about, and of course, not to mention the polonium. Use of radioactive isotope to kill an enemy in London. There's no direct fingerprints on this, but there's a hell of a lot of circumstantial evidence that he somehow is, you know, as opposed to George Bush's idea, he looked into the eyes of Putin. I think there's a good case to be made that this guy's a killer.
Well, but I mean, it's, I you know, for me, it's prove it and then, but it, what that's going back to our earlier discussion is that he created a system. I mean, that's what you described as whether he's guilty of direct orders or not. He created a system that is not only undemocratic, but is a gangster, killer, modern version of KGB system, and that is a terrifying prospect, and that in fact a reason why, you know, I believe in some way he can't leave, because if he does go, that system is certainly going to finish him. So he has to stay there and make sure that he's in control of that horror, and of course the side product of this is it is going to get only more horrible. No, I mean, but at the same time, the question for the West, what the West can do. And once he has this very cute little mini-me First Lady Medvedev right next to him, the West can do even less because Medvedev comes out and speaks English and says all the right things. And, you know, the double speak that Orwell spoke mm-hmm. out so eloquently is part of our culture, but it's really not part of the Anglo-Saxon world and English culture or many other cultures. So I think we're all stuck, really, for some time until the revolution comes.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us. And when is your book, The Lost Khrushchev Family Journey into the Gulag of the Russian Mind, coming out?
Well, hopefully in a year. I'm still finishing it.
Oh, well, I was going to say, I want to talk to you when that comes out, but maybe yes, I'll talk to you before you then.
Okay, all right.
thank you so much.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Again, I've been speaking with Nina Khrushcheva, Professor of International Affairs and a graduate program at the New School and a senior fellow at the World Policy Institute. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about how a crooked accountant apparently has maybe even affected the re-election chances of a whole lot of Democratic office holders in the state of California. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Robert Stern, president of the Center for Governmental Studies. He served as the elections counsel to the California Secretary of State's office and has drafted numerous state initiatives and was the principal co-author of California's 1974 Political Reform Act, adopted by 70% of California's voters. He was also a principal drafter of the City of Los Angeles Ethics and Public Campaign Financing Laws in 1990. And prior to joining the Center for Governmental Studies, he served as the first general counsel of California's Fair Political Practices Commission. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Stern.
Hi, Ian. Nice to be with you.
And what do you make of the damage that just this one person has done here to the Democratic Party in the state of California with... I mean, it looks like most of the office holders in California have been affected by the arrest of the treasurer Kindi Durkee. As many as 400 political accounts have been frozen by the banks. We know about, of course, Senator Feinstein, all of her money, several millions, has disappeared. Loretta Sanchez, $378,000 in cash has disappeared. $5 million, by the way, is what Feinstein may have lost. And countless others. What's your understanding of how this went on for so long?
Well, this is not unprecedented. A few years ago, the treasurer for the National Republican Congressional Committee embezzled $800,000 from that committee. So you would think that these candidates would have learned their lesson and paid a little more attention to what was going on. But she was a treasurer, I think, for Dianne Feinstein since 1992. And so Feinstein's people really respected her and thought that she was doing everything properly. And, of course, once somebody like Dianne Feinstein hires a treasurer, other people do it as well. It's just amazing to me. I mean, they're calling this woman the Bernie Madoff of campaign treasurers because she may have embezzled millions and millions of dollars. We just don't know yet because the bank accounts were frozen. It's just hard to say. But clearly what this means is that the candidates were just not minding the store, were turning over all their resources to this one person. And the ironic thing, Ian, is that the candidates themselves may be fined, the federal candidates may be fined themselves because they may have broken federal election law in the sense that they were required to have somebody, two people sign checks of $1,000 or more under Federal Election Commission rules and required to have somebody else review the bank statements. And the ironic thing was, when I talked about that Republican committee, the committee itself was fined $10,000 because their treasurer embezzled $800,000 from them.
Well, at this point, Kindi Durkee's been released on $200,000 bond. And she's only being charged, as far as I know, with having embezzled $677,000 from an assemblyman's campaign. It sounds like there's an awful lot of other cases out there. I'm surprised that that she's out on such low bail, you know, given the 400 bank accounts of office holders that have been, including the state, the California State Party's treasury as well.
Yeah, that's right. We're talking about millions and millions of dollars here. Obviously, they set the bail and they decide, what the appropriate bail is. I don't think the bail is the important question. The important question is how much money was involved and what are the candidates going to do about it. But Dianne Feinstein is reported to have said that she's going to put in, with her own money, the $5 million that she may have lost. She's wealthy. She can afford to do that. Other candidates can't. Other candidates are raising money. Lourdes Sanchez sent out a plea for money. And there is some talk about suspending the contribution limits for these candidates, which I think would be a terrible idea, so that let the candidates raise the money. I mean, after all, we're talking here about incumbents who raised money in non-election years. We're not talking about the challengers. And this would allow contributors to double their contributions, basically, to incumbents and have that much more influence over them.
Well, apparently, Feinstein's is on Friday. She sued Durkee & Associates and the bank, First California Bank, saying that they'd ignored numerous red flags. Is there anything you think, any culpability with the bank?
Well, it's possible. I just don't know how many red flags were raised. But apparently, there was one bank that handled all the accounts. We'll just have to see what the rules were in terms of the bank rules on that. But obviously the candidates are seeking the deep pockets, and the banks have the deep pockets. The campaign treasurer, I'm sure, has very, very small pockets at this point.
So, Bob Stern, since you were first general counsel of California's Fair Political Practices Commission, and apparently the state's Fair Political Practices Commission are looking into whether, in requests from some of the state lawmakers about, being able to go back to the well since the money that they've raised has disappeared now. They're asking to raise some more money. And apparently they're also asking the Federal Election Commission the same thing, to get some leeways and to go back to these maxed out donors that they've tapped already. If you were there, how would you rule?
I would say, no way.
Yeah.
These people gave you the money. They influenced you at the time they gave you the money. The whole idea of contribution limits is to reduce the impact of corruption or the appearance of corruption. Now you're going to go back and get more money from these same people so they can influence you again. I would say, sorry. I mean, you should have been minding the store. I would, however, relax the disclosure rules and say, okay, we're going to extend the deadlines for your disclosure because you can't get the bank records. So I would give them some leeway in terms of the disclosure rules. But I would say, look, you got the money from these people a year ago. At that time, they gave you $2,000 or $3,000 or $5,000. And you were very grateful at that point. And there may have been legislation at that point that you were that was up because that's why they were giving. Why should they now give you another $3,000 or $5,000 and you can be grateful again to them? Sorry, but that's just the way it goes.
And Bob Stern, we were talking about red flags or red flags that were missed. Weren't there some? Wasn't she hauled before the Fair Political Practices Commission, Kendi Durkee?
Several times, apparently.
Several times.
She filed the statements properly and incorrectly, and they fined her, but nobody was paying much attention to that. And I think my feeling is, it's just a feeling, I don't know this for truth, is that the FPPC, Fair Political Practices Commission, probably turned over some information to the FBI, and that's how this whole thing got started. But as I say, that's just my speculation, because oftentimes, if they find things that are very serious, they'll turn them over to criminal authorities. The unfortunate thing, of course, is it does take a long time to investigate these things. And in the meantime, candidates were raising money and losing money.
So, again, I'm speaking with Robert Stern, who's president of the Center for Governmental Studies, and he also served as the first general counsel to California's Fair Political Practices Commission. We're talking about the treasurer of an accounting firm, Kindy Durkee, who was arrested recently by the FBI, and subsequently many politicians have come forward and found that their bank accounts have been empty, at least their campaign bank accounts have been empty. A growing number, and in all, apparently 400 political accounts have been frozen in the state of California, which suggests that a lot of office holders are going to have a hard time. I mean, what's your reading on that, Bob, in terms of the next election?
I don't think the office holders will have that tough a time. They'll go back to their to other contributors. They are the incumbents. The challengers are going to have the tough time against the office holders. The challengers don't start raising money until the next few months. The office holders have been stockpiling money, and I'm saying, well, you know, you stockpiled the money, you lost the money. You can continue to raise the money. You have huge advantages. I mean, these are almost all incumbents. There are very few challengers. You have huge advantages as office holders. So do it what Sanchez is doing, and go out and raise some money. Not all these people are Democrats. I understand that there's at least maybe one or two Republicans, but most of these are Democrats. And obviously, it puts them at a disadvantage. I mean, for example, Laura Richardson is running against Janice Hahn for the congressional seat. Richardson lost money. Hahn did not put her money with the treasurer, and she may have some money left over from her from her last race. So Richardson is going to be at a disadvantage there. But when you look at the scheme of things, challengers are at a huge disadvantage for these incumbents, and these incumbents have been stockpiling money in the non-election year when nobody knew whether they're going to be running again or not, or who they're going to be running against. And so, in a sense, this equalizes the races for challengers and incumbents, and that's a good thing.
Well, I have to, for what it's worth, Bob, in terms of disclosure, you know, I've formed a foundation in order to raise funds to distribute my program, because Pacifica has had this program for free for decades. They've never done anything with it and have no interest in distributing it. And I've started to do it on my own. And obviously I'm trying to raise funds from foundations to help me. Guess who was about to be the treasurer on recommendations from somebody in the Democratic Party?
Well, and a lot of nonprofits actually had
I mean, I just not my accountant, but boy, I came close.
that's a story right there.
Yeah. So.
By the way, I make exceptions for the nonprofits as opposed to the incumbents.
Right. Well, I mean,
of course, there are no limits. I mean, listeners, there are no limits on how much you can give Ian.
Yeah, that's true. And please do. And it's all tax deductible. I can
that's
make a pitch.
Right. Yeah, contributions are not contributions to Ian.
That's true. So. Just the race that you mentioned there—that's a result of the not gerrymandering as is happening in a lot of the states around the country, but that's from the new law, right? That the 33rd is being redone.
Yeah, there are two things that are happening in California. One is the redistricting done by an independent commission, meaning that incumbents are being forced to run against each other: Richardson, Hahn, Berman, Sherman, and some other races. And the second thing is this top two that goes into effect next year, and listeners probably aren't as on top of this as others might be, but the top two means that everybody gets to vote for any of the candidates, whether they're Republican or Democratic, in the primary. In other words, you just don't vote for Democrats or Republicans. You vote for anybody you want.
Right.
And then the top two finishers, if there are two Democrats, for example, Berman and Sherman, they will face each other again in November.
Wow.
So what it means is that the campaigns next year are going to be much more expensive. First of all, in the primary, you're appealing to all the voters, not just your party voters. Then, secondly, you're in a runoff.
Right. Well, Bob, we're in a runoff here in the sense we'd run out of time. I thank you for joining us.
It was a lot of fun, and good luck with your foundation.
Thanks a lot, Bob. Again, I've been speaking with Robert Stern, president of the Center for Governmental Studies, and he served as the first general counsel of the California Fair Practices Political Practice Commission. We're going to take a brief station break, and we were talking about the untold history of guns and gun control in America. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Adam Winkler, who's a professor of constitutional law at the University of California, Los Angeles, and a contributing writer for The Daily Beast, Huffington Post, and Newsweek. He is the author of the new book, just out, Gunfight, The Battle Over the Rights to Bear Arms in America. Welcome to Background Briefing, Adam Winkler.
Thanks for having me.
And clearly with a presidential candidate who happens to be a front runner on the Republican side, himself very pro-gun, do you expect guns to be an issue in this coming election year, even though it seems that the Democrats have been assiduously avoiding gun control for the last several years?
I fully expect gun control to be an issue in the next election. Gun owners are very motivated and very activated in this era. Right now, the big scandal that they're focusing on is this Fast and Furious scandal. This is the botched sting operation that led to the U.S. government essentially selling guns to the Mexican drug cartels and allowing those guns to walk without following them. So I think for sure there is going to be a real interest among gun owners in the next election.
But surely, Adam Winkler, the Fast and Furious so-called scandal is a fraudulent scandal, at least to my mind. Darrell Issa has drummed it up. The Republicans are jumping on it, probably as a way to go after the Clinton administration. I know there have been various statements about how high it goes up the chain, and it seems to be a kind of fishing expedition in that regard. How can the Congress and Congress people who have endorsed the Tired Amendment that prevents any information, the very information that the ATF needs to share with local law enforcement, they're prohibited. So there seems to be more than a measure of hypocrisy here.
There's a certain irony in that those who are objecting the most to the Fast and Furious scandal are also the ones who insist that we do the least to stop the flow of guns to Mexico. So there's no doubt that there's a certain irony, but I don't think this scandal is going away, in part because I do think the Obama administration hasn't handled it very well. They have really refused to come up with information and reveal information to the investigating committees about what exactly happened here, why were these guns allowed to go to Mexico without being followed. Personally, I don't think there's any problem with the sting operation. The police do this all the time. The problem is, we need to know why did these guns go to Mexico without being followed, and whether it's a make-believe scandal or not, that certainly has never stopped political opponents from harping on some scandalous issue in the past.
But isn't the record pretty clear about particularly the supporters of the NRA, which is basically both sides of the House? One of the strategies of the NRA has been to weaken the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms and Explosives, the ATF. And they haven't had anybody in charge of the ATF now for, I think, a decade or so. And that still seems to be the case. The president's nominee is in limbo. Isn't this, I think, a little extra dose of hypocrisy as well?
Well, I guess that's right. There's one thing I found in researching my book Gunfight that you mentioned earlier is how many interesting twists and ironies there are in the story of guns in America. The truth is guns are a far more complicated subject than either of the extremes in the gun debate have really made clear. One of the funny things I found in researching Gunfight is that the NRA used to be the biggest supporter of gun control. They weren't always the diehard no-compromises opponent that we know today. And in fact, in the 1920s and 30s, the NRA was at the forefront of the gun control movement, drafting restrictive gun control laws and promoting them in state after state. In fact, I talk about in the book, when Congress was considering the first major federal gun control law in the 1930s, the president of the NRA was asked to testify before Congress and was asked whether it violated the Second Amendment. His quote, his response is pretty astounding today. He said, quote, "I have not given it any study from that point of view." So the story of the NRA is one of constant shifts and often some funny ironies. The NRA is now seeking to overturn some of those same laws that it promoted back in the 1920s and 30s.
Again, I'm speaking with Adam Winkler, the author of a new book just out, Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. Now, the story begins, your story begins, with the recent case in a ruling on the Second Amendment, the District of Columbia versus Heller. My understanding was that to some extent that was, as a constitutional lawyer, I'm sure you're aware of Supreme Court shopping. How much was that case shopped? How much did the advocates on the part of Heller want this brought to the courts?
Well, they absolutely. This was a case, District of Columbia against Heller, and it was designed to get the Supreme Court to rule on what the meaning of the Second Amendment is. It's kind of surprising that 200-some years after the Bill of Rights was adopted, the Supreme Court had really never made crystal clear what the main purpose of the Second Amendment was. And so this was very well-thought-out strategic litigation in the model of the civil rights movement. The lawyers went out and recruited very sympathetic plaintiffs. You know, most gun cases in the past were involved some criminal who had been raised a Second Amendment question as part of a desperate set of appeals. But United States against Crackhead was not a good vehicle to interpret the Second Amendment. So they went out and got sympathetic plaintiffs, and they pursued this case in the hopes of getting the Supreme Court to rule on it. In fact, one of the interesting stories I found in writing Gunfight was that the NRA opposed this lawsuit from the very beginning because they did not want the Supreme Court to rule on this issue. They were afraid of losing, obviously, a conservative Supreme Court striking down their view of the Second Amendment. But some also suspected they were afraid of winning, that they didn't want their crisis-driven fundraising techniques to be called into question when the Supreme Court said, hey, government can never come take away all your guns.
So to somebody that, you know, I wasn't born here, so sometimes I'm puzzled by how the Constitution is fought over and reinterpreted. And as you know, it's there's many arenas in which people argue about it. People that are religious say that the Founding Fathers were ruling in favor of them, and others are saying, wait a minute, the Founding Fathers were actually deists. And you know, there's endless numbers of arguments. But if just in my reading of the Second Amendment, it seems fairly straightforward that the predicate is the state shall have well-regulated militias and the citizens' rights to bear arms shall not be infringed. But the predicate seems to be the state shall have well-regulated militias. Now, how did this ruling then reverse that to make that the least important and certainly not the context and the second part, the law of the land?
Well, it's kind of complicated because what the framers meant by a militia was not what we might mean today as a militia. We think of the militia perhaps as being the National Guard, an organized select group of people who might help out with national defense. But remember, the Founding Fathers feared a standing army. They feared an organized militia. What they wanted was a well-regulated militia, but what they were referring to was a citizens' militia. We, the people, who would fight for national defense. When called out, we would go home and grab our guns and show up to fight. That's the so-called Minutemen. But one of the things I talk about in Gunfight was that the Founding Fathers, they wrote the Second Amendment, but they also had gun control. They barred large portions of the population from possessing guns, and they had restrictive militia laws that heavily regulated gun owners, including requiring them to appear at public musters where their guns would be inspected and registered on state rolls. They even had a version of the individual mandate, you know, that's proven so controversial in Obama's health care reform, the provision that requires people to go out and buy health insurance. Well, the Founding Fathers passed the Militia Act of 1792. It mandated individuals to go out and buy guns so that they could fight for the national defense should need be.
Again, I'm speaking with Adam Winkler, who is a professor of constitutional law at the University of California and the author of the new book, Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. So I guess the first big irony here is that gun control got underway as your book, which really does tell the whole historical story, not just the Founding Fathers' role, but the end of the Civil War during Reconstruction. There was a fear on the part of the white Southerners that the newly freed slaves would have arms. And curious enough, your book, Gunfight, reveals that the Ku Klux Klan was one of the, you know, the first advocates of gun control.
Well, before the Civil War, blacks in the South were never allowed to own guns. But during the war, blacks got their hands on guns for the first time. Some served in black units of the Union Army, and the Union Army allowed them to take their guns home. Others just purchased guns on the black market, which was flooded with firearms produced for the war effort. Racist whites began to form posses like the KKK that would go out at night terrorizing blacks, invading their homes, with the purpose of taking those guns away. Whites knew that if they disarmed the freedmen, they wouldn't be able to fight back. And one of the things I show in Gunfight is that the history of guns in America has been deeply intertwined with issues of race and racism.
And another little irony here is that people, as you point out, that there's a lot more to this story than gun nuts versus gun grabbers. The simplistic way that most of the arguments over gun control have panned out, and obviously there's much more texture here and much more history and much more nuance, but one of the other ironies here, Adam Winkler, is that Ronald Reagan, a conservative, also brought about gun control in part because the Black Panthers scared the hell out of a lot of white conservatives.
That's right. In Gunfight, I tell the story of one, I think, of the most amazing spectacles in the history of the gun debate. And it was in May 1967 when 30 members of the Black Panthers marched into the California Capitol building, openly carrying loaded rifles, pistols, and shotguns. They weren't there to commit violence. They were there to protest a proposed gun control law, a proposed gun control law that was being promoted by conservatives in California who were seeking to disarm the Panthers. In fact, the 1960s saw a number of gun control laws enacted to restrict access to guns by blacks, laws that were supported by, like you say, Ronald Reagan. And ironically, these laws fueled the rise of the modern gun rights movement, a movement that is famous for being white, rural, and politically conservative.
So when did it change then, in the sense that the lines are pretty much drawn now where it's liberal, urban, female voters on the Democratic side? I think the champion of gun control is California Senator Dianne Feinstein. So when did it switch from the conservative to the liberal side?
Well, things really switched in the early 1970s. As I mentioned earlier, the NRA used to be a big supporter of gun control law. And what happened was is that after the laws of the 1960s, the modern gun rights movement rose along with the general rise of the new conservatism, or the new right, as it's often called, that propelled Ronald Reagan to the White House in 1980. And the NRA actually undergoes a coup by a group of hardline members who take over at the annual meeting in 1977, oust the entire board, put their own people in place, and recommit the NRA to a hard-line view of the Second Amendment. So things really changed in the 1970s, in part in response to the laws that were designed to disarm the Black Panthers. White conservatives thought the government was coming to get their guns next.
So it's this almost describing a kind of Tea Party takeover of the Republican Party. Is that an analogy? Because I remember talking to a former counselor of the NRA who wrote a book basically saying that he broke with the leadership because they were too extreme, that they were using excessive paranoia as a fundraising tool, and that they were in many ways out of step with some of their rank and file. I believe there was a poll done suggesting that I think the majority of NRA members actually would favor some sensible gun control.
I think that's absolutely right. I think the majority of gun owners out there would support more and more effective gun control laws. But I tell you why they don't, and because I think they're really convinced that the government is coming to take their guns away. And I think one of the things that I think my friends on the liberal side should do is not fight so much to get rid of all the guns. If liberals can accept that there is a basic right of self-defense that involves a firearm, I think that will do much in the long run to calm the waters of the gun debate. Now, of course, the other side has to compromise as well, and maybe not push to have guns on campuses or not push to have guns on airplanes, as some have even suggested we should have, because, you know, that would be great to have a shootout at 10,000 feet if someone tried to commit some criminal act out there. At least that's what they suggest. So I think both sides need to compromise, but it's true that we have been sort of dominated in this country by the extremes on both sides, and that the answer, the story of guns in America, is actually much more balanced and much more nuanced. We've always had gun rights, but we've also always had gun control.
Well, of course, what tends to happen, though, with the political debate, the gun control people tend to get a bit of wind in their sails when there's some horrible massacre, the latest of which was the Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords. And of course, it's no small irony that the Republican Party down in Arizona recently gave out a Glock similar to the one that was used to shoot Gabrielle Giffords, kill a federal judge, and kill a young child and a bunch of other people. I think they maybe later apologized for it not being in the best of taste. But one of the things that the gun rights people say, and I believe it's very effective, it's like the argument over torture, you know, the ticking bomb. We have to torture people because of the ticking bomb, even though people inside the government that I've spoken to, like the FBI guy in charge of going after Al-Qaeda and a CIA guy I spoke with recently, they all say that it's absolutely nonsensical. It nevertheless resonates with the public. And I think, as far as I can tell, what resonates with the public is when there is a mass shooting, what the NRA say, if only somebody there had had a gun, they could have stopped it. And I remember speaking to the young fellow that was shot at Virginia Tech, who very, very eloquently, totally devastated that argument. But there was a case recently in a shootout in Texas where some National Guardsmen were killed. and apparently somebody did have a gun, but the guy that was shooting everybody had an AK-47, and the guy, I think, had a pistol, and he figured he was outmatched and didn't want to use it.
That's right. It seems hard for me to believe that we're going to increase public safety by encouraging people to shoot, to take out their guns and start gunfights with some mass shooter out there. I don't think that's likely to be very effective, and especially it could be a problem for police who then have to sort out a situation and come restore order, and they don't know who is the killer and who is the person who's coming to everyone's defense. So it can really mess things up. At the same time, I think there is something to be said about the idea that having schools like I'm at UCLA declaring that a gun-free zone, it's not really a gun-free zone. I mean, it's just by law you're not allowed to have a gun here, but we don't search anyone's backpack when they come on campus. So calling it a gun-free zone does not really make it a gun-free zone. And so if there is a legitimate reason to have a gun for self-defense in public, and many people will disagree about that, but if there is such a reason, then declaring an area a gun-free zone probably is not going to work to keep the bad guys from having guns either. So, again, I think both sides in the gun debate are probably a little bit wrong about this, and that the answer is really coming up with better and effective gun control laws that might actually work. Not passing a law because we're in the emotional throes of some kind of crisis because there's been some shooting. We don't get great legislation there. We wouldn't get great legislation, anti-terror legislation, after 9/11. That's the wrong time that you want to try to come up with good, thoughtful, effective laws.
Well, just in closing, though, Adam Winkler, you point out in your new book, Gunfight, that much of the mythology about the Wild West is completely off point, that gun violence was actually rare and restrictive gun control was quite commonplace in the West. So I guess, to some extent, does that point the finger at Hollywood? Because, you know, I can't get by without seeing a poster of some pretty young blonde holding a big gun that she's clearly uncomfortable with. Every movie poster has a gun pointing at you, almost.
Well, I come from a Hollywood family, so I don't want to put the blame there. But we do all know the image.
But you agree with me, though.
Of a gunslinger walking around a Wild West town, six shooters on each hip, a rifle in each hand, as a duel on Main Street every day at noon. But one of the remarkable things I discovered in writing Gunfight was that our popular understanding of the Wild West couldn't be more inaccurate. The frontier towns, places like Dodge City, Deadwood, Tombstone, had the most restrictive gun laws in the nation. Everyone had guns out in the untamed wilderness, but when you came into town where the civilized folk lived, you had to check your guns like you'd check your coat at a Boston restaurant in winter. And it turns out there was very little gun violence in these towns, which saw an average of less than 2 murders a year. Turns out that there really wasn't much reason to get out of Dodge.
Well, notwithstanding that, at least in my experience, I've seen a million posters with a gun pointed at you. But isn't there an association, not that psychologically the guns actually solve problems, which I think is a very destructive kind of social lesson to propagate, but I'm just curious to know why guns are associated with manliness and solving problems. Because, for example, in Australia, where I come from, if anybody pulled a gun out at a fight, they would be considered absolutely disgusting and a completely cowardly worm of an individual that real men use their fists. So in terms of gun control, is there any way that dissociation between guns and solving problems and being manly could be broken? Because it seems ultimately to be unhealthy.
I think you're right. It is unhealthy. Ironically, by the way, some of our earliest gun control laws were passed in southern states specifically designed to stop people from pulling out a gun at the slightest sign of dishonor and entering into a duel. In the old days, it used to be thought that carrying a concealed weapon was the kind of thing only a scoundrel would do. Today, however, the gun rights movement really promotes concealed carry of firearm and tries to liberalize the laws so that everyone can have a gun out on the street hidden from view. So certainly, like so many things about the story of guns in America, things are much different today than they once were. And by perhaps looking back at the past and seeing how we've balanced gun control and gun rights, maybe we can start to change the dynamics of the gun debate in America.
Thank you again for joining us, Adam.
Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Adam Winkler, the author of the new book, Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. So what do we learn on Background Briefing today? Well, we began talking about the musical chairs in the Kremlin, how Putin has suddenly stepped out of the shadow of his puppet Medvedev, who's the current president, to reassume the role as the next president of Russia, a role he never really relinquished. We were joined by Nina Khrushcheva, who's a relative of the former Soviet leader Khrushchev. She's a professor in international relations at the New School, and somebody that is really up on what's going on in Russia. Clearly, she's got very good connections. And essentially, you know, the West has been deluding itself about Putin. They just don't want to believe what is really obvious, that the guy's a gangster, that he runs KGB Incorporated, that he regulates the theft of Russia through by the KGB and by the crony billionaires, or the authorized billionaires. And the minute one billionaire doesn't play ball with the Kremlin, he goes to jail, like the head of Yukos, Khodorkovsky. So I eventually asked her, I said, well, you know, does this mean that we're not wrong in being delusional? Because if you really face up to it, you know, there's so much evidence about Putin's role in starting the Second Chechen War, in the murder of the journalist Anna Politkovskaya, the use of polonium, the radioactive isotope to kill a KGB defector in London, all of the evidence that maybe Putin's been, you know, giving the orders like a mafia boss. And she said, yes, at the end of the day, you have to pretty much accept that, that he is a killer and he is running a group of killers, and that he probably will end up with the same fate as Beria, the head of the KGB under Stalin, and that he stays in there because he has to regulate the killers before they kill him. Then we spoke with Bob Stern, president of the Center for Governmental Studies, about this extraordinary case here in California where a local accountant has fleeced the campaign funds of most of the top Democratic office holders, including the Senator Feinstein and Congresswoman Loretta Sanchez. 400 bank accounts have been frozen. Millions of dollars have disappeared. And this, we were looking into how much this is going to affect some of the important races here in California. These office holders are going to have to go back to their donors. They're trying to get special exemption. So it's an amazing, it's amazing how she got away with it for so long, this crooked accountant. And then finally, we talked with Adam Winkler, who's got his new book, Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. And there was actually some fascinating information I hadn't heard about before. I didn't realize that gun control actually was started during Reconstruction by racist Southerners who were afraid that the free slaves would get guns. The Ku Klux Klan, of all people, began as a gun control organization, and that the modern gun rights movement was inspired by a fear of the Black Panthers, Ronald Reagan being one of the champions of that movement. So, very interesting. I'm Ian Masters. This has been Background Briefing. This program is available for podcasts, and you can sign up there at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.